afternoon. It's not good when you start out with oops. I don't know. Maybe it is. Maybe that's a
it's a little crazy in here.
Oops.
Headphones not working.
I know. We have cords everywhere. I think it was a radio station or something. Welcome to another episode. It is always an episode, isn't it, of We the People Radio. My name is Aaron Ryan.
My name is Bill Cunliffe. And we have a sponsor this hour. It's Pape Machinery. They're our local John Deere Ag and Turf dealer up on Twin View Boulevard, 3119 Twin View Boulevard in the city of Shasta Lake. They're everything John Deere, and let me tell you, folks, it's going to get busy. Sun's coming out, grass is growing, and you better get your stuff ready to go. Get in and get it serviced, get it tuned up, get new blades, and get ready to cut some grass. Also, if you're looking for a new tractor or a trade-in on an old one, go up and see them. They've got a great inventory right now. Or give them a call. Their phone number is 530-226-9226. They can take care of all your John Deere needs. They've got great financing. I think they still have 0% available for tractors right now. So go up and see them or catch them on the interweb at www.papemachinery.com.
We're going to have Bill's lips removed. I wanted to take him in for the surgery.
I wanted to be concise.
Yeah, you're concise. All right. Go to timeout. We need like a hockey, you know, like in hockey. Put him in the penalty box.
Penalty box?
Go to the box.
You'd be in there already. There would be room for me.
That's true. I blundered at the beginning. I got my blunder out of the way early. Oh, my goodness. Well, I hope that you were making use of the archives, actually, at wethepeopleradio.us. We joke around a lot, but not really. One of the things on there, we do tons of shows on marijuana. The tab at the top of the page says, or the side, whatever, however you're looking at it, says pot. So pretty easy to find. And on that page, you will find a lot of resources. Bunches of shows, but a lot of resources. And all of our archived shows, they have they're commercial free. They're free to listen to. It's an MP3 file. You can download it. It's not there's no copywriting. You don't have to worry about it. You can share it with friends. You can burn it on CDs and sell it for a fundraiser. We don't care. We just want you to use the information. And there's not a day goes by that I don't speak with somebody who is impacted by the whole cannabis deal one way or the other, or has questions about it, and they don't really know what's going on with it. They don't have the information. So people are not really able to fight back adequately or speak out adequately because they are uninformed. And I don't mean that in a mean way. If that's not something that's in your world, you're thinking, well, I don't need to know that. But
yeah, and then
you
usually
do.
Yeah, and by the time that you figure it out, it's almost too late.
Yeah. So that's Kathy, by the way.
Hi.
The voice of Kathy, because that's what happened last time. They thought we were the same person. I was just like ventriloquisting myself. This like super low voice. It's kind of hard to miss, but okay. And then we have Officer Joe
She's
with us this
voice
morning
like
as well.
Merman.
Who's going to be talking about marijuana for vets and why we shouldn't do it?
Yes, with our guest. So just having said that, I really, really hope you make use of these programs that just have incredible experts. So our guest today is Dr. Bertha Madras, and she is the director at the Laboratory of Addiction Neurobiology. Maybe I should someone else read this. Finally had my cataracts done, and now my mouth won't work. What the heck?
Oh, Aaron, I have faith in you.
Oh, goodness, I'm looking through these stupid reading glasses. So let's see. She is a professor of psychobiology at Harvard Medical School, based in McLean Hospital and cross-appointed at the Massachusetts General Hospital. Her research focuses on neurobiology, imaging, and medications developed for neuropsychiatric disorders. Seems like a good topic that we keep hearing about all the time and that they lie about all the time. In public policy, she was the deputy director for demand reduction in the White House Office of National Drug Control Policy and a presidential appointment confirmed unanimously by the U.S. Senate. So Dr. Madras is not somebody who's just, you know, giving her opinion and all of that. She she knows stuff. She recently served as a panelist at the Vatican Pontifical Academy of Sciences and in 2017 was appointed as one of six members of the President's Commission on Combating Drug Addiction and the Opioid Crisis. In service to the public, she developed a museum exhibit and CD licensed by Disney, interestingly enough, with the Museum of Science in Boston. She's the recipient of an NIH Merit Award, NIDA Public Service Award, and others. And so we've got more, but I'm not going to read all that because I would like her to tell us about it. But just so people understand, we are really, really endeavoring to bring you the top people that are working on this to give you the very best information so you can make informed decisions.
And current information.
That too. Speeding forward from the 1960s when THC was 2%. Yeah, fast forward. So where would we like to start today, Dr. Madras?
Oh, good afternoon.
Yes.
We can start wherever you'd like because there are so many topics to be covered that are crucial for public information. So you fire away and let's begin.
Dr. Madras, this is Officer Joe. First of all, I want to thank you so much for coming to this show and addressing our national audience. Locally here in California, we are now seeing the dispensaries doing their PSA and giving away free marijuana to vets, saying it is for PTSD. They're very careful about not actually doing a recommendation, something which they could be held liable for civilly. But they make it as a part of their package. So when they give it away, they say, we're giving away marijuana free to veterans with PTSD. And then they have, of course, the anecdotal evidence that the veterans are saying that it actually helps them. And I know I had written to you and asked you to perhaps talk to us about how effective marijuana is for PTSD and if it, in fact, causes more harm than good.
Well, that's a great question. The really good clinical trials haven't been done, but there have been a number of studies that are reported that show that, in fact, marijuana is not a great and effective treatment for PTSD, other than the self-reports of individuals. I never discount those. But if the data, if the statistics say that overall it's not effective, then one has to base your opinion on the overall data. The other thing that the data say is that marijuana can make PTSD worse, not better, in a number of people who have tried it for this purpose. So overall, I would say that anyone who recommends it for PTSD, and especially the vulnerable veterans in our nation who've been through a lot of challenges in their lives and have had a lot to deal with, this probably is not a drug that I would recommend for PTSD based on what is published now in the literature.
So my study of it, Dr. Madras, and you can comment on this, because from what I understand, it actually, in veterans with PTSD, it can increase suicidality. Is that your understanding?
Well, there is some evidence that it does increase suicidality, not only in veterans, but in young people as well. In Colorado... We've seen an increase in suicidality amongst youth, and the drug that's most often found on board with these children who've completed a suicide or have discussed suicide, the drug that's most often found is marijuana. So there is an overlap between the two. We don't understand the mechanism, but we certainly have the correlation between the two. And from my purposes, from my perspective, if there's a correlation, that's enough of a signal to stay away from a drug that could make your psychological state a lot worse.
So in follow-on to that, according to my research, again, marijuana use is linked to aggressive behavior and domestic violence and can cause or exacerbate psychosis or produce paranoia, all of which can lead to violence and homicide. And I've tracked over, something like 1,000 cases, recent cases of either serial murderers or people that had PTSD that then went on to have violent episodes. Have you found in your research any correlation of that at all?
Well, there is more and more evidence linking marijuana to violence. And it's something that people have dismissed for years because the user consistently reports that marijuana mellows them out, makes them feel better. But the literature, the scientific literature on the association between marijuana and violence is growing. And I think there are two reasons for it. One is that the very potent forms of marijuana could, in fact, be related to an increased level of violence. And number two is that people who are in withdrawal seem to have a greater tendency to violence. So both of these, you know, higher potency or in withdrawal, both of these could be very important factors in promoting violence. Anecdotally, there are many cases in the media, which occasionally I do not trust at all, but for people who've been involved in very high-profile cases of fighting with police or, in fact, in mass murders, there has been reasonably good reports that they were heavy marijuana users. You know, I think of the Boston bomber during the Boston Marathon in, I believe it was 2013. They were both heavy marijuana users, the brothers who developed the bombs and exploded them in innocent people who were either bystanders or running. So we see that in a number of other cases in which there is mass murders, that the kids who are involved in these appear to have been heavy marijuana users. The problem is that I would love to see their data. I would love to see their blood levels or urine levels, either post-mortem or right after the episode, to verify it, but I don't have access to their data, so that I would have to just say that I'm claiming reports from the media rather than from a scientific document that would say, yes, these were heavy marijuana users. They're just anecdotal reports that have been published by the media.
There are so many, though, it's pretty hard to say that that's not a factor. We have posted on our website, there's a little link there that says shooters, terrorists, and mass killers who used marijuana. And when you click on that, it pulls up a very long list with the links to the stories where that was set. So it isn't just a list like, oh, we're just claiming everybody who did something bad was involved with this. It shows the links to all the stories. But it goes way back. This just didn't happen in the last 5 years. I mean, this is stretching out now for decades.
And Dr. Madras, for you,
it's been stretching out for a very long time, and it's very worrisome because, especially with young people, I think that the loss of judgment that one has under the influence of marijuana, combined with the fact that if they're in withdrawal or they can't access or they don't have money to maintain the high levels that they're used to, then it really can incur violence. Plus, the fact that marijuana can also induce psychosis in vulnerable people, especially young people. And if they're in a state of psychosis, part of the spectrum of effects, part of the spectrum of the characteristics of psychosis is paranoia. it's believing that people are against you, that people are out to get you, that the CIA is spying on you, that people are broadcasting through your teeth, others, and all these forms that paranoia can take may be exaggerated or may be in fact induced by marijuana, because there's no question that there is a very strong association between marijuana use and psychosis. And we're reaching the point where we have at least 6 bullet points of what is causal as opposed to what is association. And there are at least 5 of those 6 indicators that suggest that marijuana is in fact causal. It's not just a coincidental association with psychosis.
Dr. Madras, when we come back from break, I'm going to ask you about drug interactions.
Not in all cases, not in the majority, but in specific cases of individuals, it can take the form of violence or can be expressed as a form of violence.
And I think that's something that the public needs to become very, very aware of for their own kids, for you know, for anybody that they where they're making decisions on the accessibility of this and the effects it may have. We've got to come right back. We've got a break. Our guest is Dr. Bertha Madras. She is a professor of psychobiology in the Department of Psychiatry at Harvard Medical School. You're listening to We the People. You can find us at wethepeopleradio.us. Science going on here.
No.
Talking to Dr. Bertha Madras from the Harvard Medical School. She's a professor of psychobiology in the Department of Psychiatry. And Officer Joe had a question.
So, Dr. Madras, as a practicing psychiatrist, one of the things I'm always concerned for you as healthcare professionals is the harmful drug and medicine interactions with marijuana. And I know that from what I understand, that it can, if you're treating a patient, for example, who has PTSD, or a young patient who a parent has brought in for psychotherapy, and medication is prescribed to that patient, that there are, it can change how sedatives react in the body, how Anabuse can react in the body, Prozac, and some other drugs. Could you discuss any of those interactions? Have they ever come up in your practice?
I do not practice. I have to preface that. I'm a basic neuroscientist by training, so that everything that I relate to you is based on my knowledge of the literature and my own research, my own laboratory research, as well as research in public policy. The important thing to remember is there are 2 things to be afraid of in terms of marijuana interactions with drugs. One is that cannabidiol, which is found in most marijuana preparations, interferes with the P450 metabolic system. So that if medications are given that use the system for metabolism, the medication dose may be completely inaccurate and may be much higher if cannabidiol is present to block the metabolism of prescribed medications. That's one important issue. The second important issue is that certain symptoms, certain psychiatric symptoms, which include depression, anxiety, stress, suicidality, treatment for opioid use disorder. All of these can be derailed by the introduction of marijuana into the system, because marijuana can, in fact, increase symptoms of depression, increase anxiety, increase stress. It can interfere with treatment for opioid use disorder. There's very interesting literature on that. And it can also interfere with treatment for other substance use disorders. So that it's important to recognize that for a whole range of issues, the co-use of legitimate pharmaceuticals with marijuana is not a wise idea, due to metabolic interactions as well as marijuana worsening psychiatric symptoms.
And
of course, I left out psychosis, which should be the number one issue.
Dr. Madras, is there any difference between, whether they smoke it or eat it, or, you know, is there any distinction in your research that you're finding based on how people are interacting with this?
Yes, it's fascinating because in emergency department mentions, smoking and especially high doses of marijuana appear to be associated with an increasing prevalence of cannabis hyperemesis syndrome, which is uncontrollable vomiting that can be so unpleasant that the person is really just wants to crawl out of their skin. They just have nonstop vomiting. Some of them absolutely refuse to accept the fact that this vomiting is due to marijuana. But lo and behold, if you stop the marijuana, the vomiting disappears. And smoking is the route of administration that's most likely to lead to it. The edibles, the gummy bears, the brownies, the drinks, they appear to be more associated with emergency department mentions of psychosis. So now that doesn't mean that smoking will not precipitate a psychotic reaction. It does not mean that eating gummy bears will avoid hyperemesis syndrome, but it does mean that there's a higher prevalence of people who smoke, who have uncontrolled vomiting. There's a higher prevalence of people who eat marijuana through, edibles that have a higher prevalence of psychosis. But there seems to be a little bit of a distinction. We'd love to see more research on it to see if that shakes out with hundreds of thousands of people rather than a few hundred or a few thousand.
So do you think so there's a whole school of thought that, well, if we just legalized it nationwide, we took it off the schedule as a drug, and we, allowed it to be, regulated by the government, blah, blah, blah. And they've done a great job in California regulating it so far. I just want to point that out.
And get FDA approval.
Oh, and get FDA approval. Can you see any path forward on that makes any sense?
Zero.
Yay.
How's that for a definitive
answer? I believe we call that fail.
And this is an epic fail. So let's take a look at some of the promises made. The promises made is that if you legalize, you will be able to regulate it. We'll get rid of the illegal market.
Yeah, that's worked out well here.
A windfall of taxes. And we will prevent young people from having access to it.
Right.
Epic fail on every one of these. In fact, in California, the illegal market is now bigger than the legal market, and it's grown bigger than ever before because there are more users.
Yeah.
Because there isn't as much stigma associated with using it. It's legal after all. So we have a lot more users. because of the higher potency that the legal market brought in, we have a lot more people with cannabis or marijuana use disorder, call it addiction, call it whatever politically correct name there is for it currently, but there are more people addicted to it. There is more market share for it in the illegal market. The Chinese have moved in to support illegal production. The tax windfalls are nowhere where they were predicted, and more young people are using than ever before, and more are using daily, which is an incredibly high risk for them. So in every possible way, legalization is a grand fail. Now, let's talk about medicalization. Right now, the evidence for cannabis as an effective medicine is on extremely shaky ground other than self-reports. All the so-called meta-analysis, where you take into account all the literature that's been published in every domain, and don't talk about Sativex or Marinol or any of these purified products. Let's talk about what's out in the market in dispensaries. There is absolutely very, very, very little or zero evidence that cannabis is an effective treatment for Parkinson's, for Alzheimer's,
Cancer.
Even for pain, for anxiety, for stress, for sleep disorders. You name it, the evidence is so thin. And if the FDA were to approve it, what would they approve? A plant with 20%, 30%, shatters and dabs with 90%, high THC, low CBD, high CBD, lower THC, a plant that has herbicide contamination, pesticide contamination, what would the FDA approve? Would they require, and they would, a dose response for every single medical indication that the states have so dramatically misused? For example, Illinois has 40 medical indications. I believe New Jersey has a very high number. Not one of them, not one has gone through any type of FDA process on dose response, on purity, on metabolism, effective dose. None of them. Indications, contraindications, side effect profile for different doses, and objective measures of positive outcomes. Just as an excess, how could the FDA possibly approve a substance of unknown purity, unknown strength, unknown actions and reactions and side effects for 40 diseases? The whole thing was created out of whole cloth. Many of the states that list these indications, including some that say for anything that the patient says is working to help them, it's just science fiction. It's not science.
Yeah,
the FDA would be derelict if they ever, ever tried to say that marijuana is now a effective medicine.
Well, and don't you think in reality the dealers or whatever you want to call them, they really don't want it FDA approved, because then they lose all control over their products?
Well, in reality, there are two reasons that they don't want FDA approval. Number one is that the cost would go sky high, because it takes a lot of money to do these studies. The FDA would then begin to really regulate it, and the regulatory oversight is what creates such high costs in pharmaceuticals. And third, they don't want the FDA
Right.
To show evidence that it doesn't work.
Right. 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 Exactly.
Well, also, I don't know how, you know, as long as it's being sold in these private co-ops, how they could ever regulate potency, quality.
They can't.
All those things. I mean, if you're gonna approve it, then all of that would have to be under pretty tight scrutiny, so that if somebody did go in there for a prescription, that they got exactly what was prescribed. And I don't see any way they can do that with the quality of the product that they're selling right now. I mean, you walk in and talk to a 18-year-old herbologist, and he's going to tell you how
butt tender.
Butt tender. He's the expert you're going to go to on your physical problem. I don't know how that would work.
And he would be practicing medicine without a license.
Yeah.
Oopsie.
Or without a pharmacy license.
Yeah.
So, I mean, they don't, of course they don't want the FDA involved. Of course, you know, when people spent, there were three billionaires that catalyzed this, what I call this marijuana mess on our country. These three billionaires spent over $100 million to promote medical and legal marijuana state by state. They could have taken that money and given it to people for clinical trials, but they didn't.
Yeah.
Because if they had done that, it would have been a benign and I think a judicious and conscientious way to spend money. But they didn't. They wanted to do an end run around the FDA, and the way you do an end run around the FDA is you get a ballot initiative, you get ads, you cozy up to the media. The media are really at fault here.
Yeah.
You get people to believe that this is a medicine, and therefore they're going to vote it as a medicine, which is not the way our nation has protected the public from phony products for dozens and dozens of years. But they did an end run around the FDA, and now we have voted a medicine. Can you imagine doing the same for a cancer therapy, which we did once in our history with Laetril? Can you imagine doing that for an antibiotic or a vaccine?
Cancer medication.
And growing it in your backyard.
Yeah, and then you
and
can
growing
grow
it in your backyard.
Yeah.
Well, it's
always amazed me that you hear these stories about these, you know, diet pills and different things that hit the market, and there's adverse reaction to it, and boy, they step right up and they get that jerked off the market, and it's gone. But they don't do that with marijuana, and you know they're getting reports of adverse reactions, and yet they don't touch it.
We have to take a quick break since I'm the official fun killer this hour. So the official fun killer says, time for break. We'll be right back. Our guest is Dr. Bertha Madras. You are listening to We the People, and you can find us at wethepeopleradio.us.
Brother bought a coconut, he bought it for the diamond. Sister had another one, she paid it for the lime. She put the lime in the coconut, she drank and pulled up. She put the lime in the coconut, she called the doctor, woke him up and said, doctor, ain't there nothing I can take? I said, doctor, to relieve this bellyache. I said, doctor, ain't there nothing I can...
Who is it?
Stop using pot. Oh, sorry.
So, Dr. Madras, we're back at We the People Radio.
Wonderful.
And I wanted you to know that we're taking action. We're producing. We're going to start producing a national PSA campaign that all of our prevention groups will be able to take these PSAs, use them in social media, any radio station that wants them. They're going to be done for free. And today, you are going to get to hear the first one. And I hope that our engineer is ready for us. Engineer, let's hear that PSA.
In that marijuana helps PTSD. This is Navy carrier pilot call sign 6 with a message to veterans. Local marijuana hucksters are offering free samples to veterans claiming that marijuana helps PTSD. These claims are not supported by legitimate medical studies, the VA or the FDA. Will you join me to protect our youth and our country from psychosis-inducing high-potency THC use? For the truth, please visit the International Academy on the Science and Impact of Cannabis at www.IndiaAlphaSierraIndiaCharlie1.org. Thank you.
So, Dr. Madras, coming back to the American Psychiatric Association, I note that they do not endorse cannabis. And I also note that this is very interesting. There hasn't been one medication ever in time that's ever been smoked. So we don't have medicines out there that are smoked. That's just not a route of administration for legitimate medicine.
Yeah, you go to the pharmacy and they give you a book of matches.
And the other thing that's interesting.
We still have books of matches?
The paraphernalia.
Yeah, yeah. There's a book of matches and a little pipe.
You need to consult with the pharmacist on how to light the matches?
Dr. Madras, I had the opportunity the other day to listen to Sir Robin Murray, a researcher that you probably know over in England, that talked about the difference between what's going on in Europe and why Amsterdam and Sweden and some of these other very liberal jurisdictions over there that used to be able to go and smoke cannabis, that they're pulling back from that because of all the problems. And would you like
to... And so is Holland.
Yeah, and so is Holland, yes. If you'd like to talk about that at all, I'm certainly interested.
Well, it's very interesting because what was prevalent in the 1960s and 70s is certainly not what we have now on the market. Because of legalization, because of normalization, we have created an entire industry that never existed before. The Mexican cartels, the family grows, never were really focused on developing high potency, high delivery methods for marijuana. Now, because there's commercialization, there's money to invest in creating new products, in creating products that are very susceptible, that are very attractive for young people, and, of course, the extremely high-potency products, which are gaining more and more of a market share. As these new products come on the market, there's increasing evidence that high-potency marijuana confers even a greater risk than the earlier versions, the older forms of marijuana. The progression to addiction is faster. The number of people using who become addicted is higher. The incidence of psychosis is higher. There are so many consequences to the use of potent marijuana that are just beginning to emerge because a lot of the biomedical literature has to catch up with this. A lot of the statements that were made in earlier publications about the association with psychosis are obsolete now because the high potency is just conferring a much greater risk. With young people, high potency also is associated with greater incidences of a greater risk, I should say, of psychiatric problems such as depression, anxiety. It's associated with higher levels of addiction to other drugs as well. And as I said, more rapid progression to becoming addicted. So in every possible way, these newly potent forms of marijuana, which have been cropping up in Europe as well as in the United States, are setting off alarm bells in Europe. I'm going to be in Sweden, in fact, in about a month or so, to discuss at many levels what the consequences are that we know now of high-potency marijuana and why, unfortunately, in this country, every attempt to limit the potency of marijuana has been derailed by the industry.
Hmm.
Why? Because the more potent, the more addiction, the more customers, the more profit.
Exactly.
Dr. Madras, are there any safe levels of THC in the body? Because here in California, when you go into a store and you see their gummies, they're saying that they are, and I don't know how they're testing their potency in any fashion whatsoever, but, and we know from Anresco Labs here, which is our major cannabis testing lab, they did 1,000 samples of NorCal in Northern California. And of those 1,000 samples that they did, over 80% of them were adulterated with something that was harmful to the human body. But going back to my original question, are there any safe levels of THC? And California, you're getting a dosage of 10 milligrams. But we know, through the literature and through reports from people like Dr. Finn, that his emergency room patients are talking about they're coming in with 5,000 milligrams of THC on board.
Yeah.
So could you address any of that?
And Dr. Libby Stute as well in Colorado is showing the same thing. People are using amounts that are beyond anything any of us ever imagined could be used. They're not safe. So what is the answer to the question, are there safe doses? I think the most important guidance of all is that if a dose produces intoxication, it de facto is not safe, whether it's a 3% THC or a 90% THC. Intoxication as a state of mind is an unsafe dose. But we also have to take into consideration that as the dose increases, the dose of THC, which is the major psychoactive component of marijuana, as the dose increases, the consequences get greater and greater. But if you're taking enough to become intoxicated, to become high, it means that you're compromised in terms of your ability to think, to judge, to drive a car, to engage in any kind of function that requires your brain to be working clearly. You know, let alone to operate a nuclear power plant, let alone to
operate a brain surgeon.
How about operating a train?
Or flying an airplane, a commercial airliner. So I think the guidance should be that a person who's intoxicated de facto has taken a dose that is unsafe. Now, people do develop tolerance to marijuana, which means that they need higher and higher potencies or more doses to get the same effect. In fact, marijuana produces tolerance very rapidly. So some people at 10 milligrams may not be intoxicated because they're already tolerant. They've already become, their brains are so used to it that in order to develop an intoxicating amount, they have to get more THC into their system. So we have to recognize that. It all depends on the individual and what they're used to. I've heard of a case in Colorado of a young man who ate a brownie that was handed to him free by one of these dispensaries, and he became psychotic and jumped out of a window because that was his first exposure.
Right. Wow.
And so we have those cases that are very alarming because people who are not tolerant, who are not used to it, have very, very robust reactions that you only get at very high doses in people that are tolerant. So it's not a simple answer. I think empirically it's what makes your brain dysfunctional that's considered an unsafe dose.
Recently, I attended a training that was put on by our HR department, and one of the topics was drug-free workplace. We have a a fairly difficult time hiring people that can pass a drug test. But what they said they were running into was if people are marijuana users and they know they're going to be tested, there's products out there that they can take right before the test that will they mask the marijuana in their system, but they also confuse the test to where it comes back inconclusive. Can you speak about that? I don't know, you know, if they come back with an inconclusive drug test, in the eyes of our department, they're not hireable for, I think, 6 months. They have to take it again. But I think people are under the impression that, hey, I'm going to get drug tested. I'll just drink some of this stuff, and then I'll pass my drug test. What can you tell us about that?
Yeah, to be frank, I haven't heard of this way to circumvent a positive drug test, so I don't know what the mechanism is. But I can't say inconclusive would give me cause to be concerned, especially in safety-sensitive jobs. And the other way to circumvent this is to say that if we do hire you, you will be subject to random testing, not for cause, but just randomly.
Right.
And that could give you a very good awareness of whether or not that person is a habitual user or not. The military's having the same problem, of course.
Sure.
And they've had it for a number of years now in terms of recruiting. They're finding that young people who in the past were they had plenty of eligible candidates. They now are having a hard time because they're physically unfit and they are drug users. And the problem is with looming concerns about wars with China, with other nations, I don't think that this is a direction that our country wants to go in, especially for youth and especially for pregnant women and the elderly. I can go on and on.
There's
so many subpopulations that are really at very high risk of using.
Well, it in the past, before this became such a huge issue in our society, if a inconclusive test came back, it was deemed you passed the test. You didn't come back positive, and that's all they were looking for. Now they have included inconclusive in the as a same rating as a positive test, pretty much. You can't be hired with an inconclusive test. So I just want people out there to realize if their local bud tender, and I guess they sell these products right there at these pot shops,
I wasn't paying attention. And the news is going to cut us off. Hold that thought. We'll be right back. You're listening to We the People Radio. Radio. My name is Aaron Ryan.
Hello, Aaron.
Hello, Bill.
Hi, my name is Bill Cundiff. And
what do you have for us today, Bill?
Well,
want me to help you do the commercial? I know you like it when
You know, I'm going to just try to freelance it if that's okay with you, Aaron. Our sponsor this hour is Pape Machinery. They're our local John Deere Ag and Turf dealer. And right now, you can go down and get yourself a great deal on a John Deere tractor or mower or whatever John Deere product you're looking for. They're located at 3119 Twin View Boulevard in the city of Shasta Lake. And they got great financing, great inventory levels right now. So go down and see them. Spring's right around the corner. Or you can give them a call. The phone number is 530-226-9226. Or you can catch them on the web at papemachinery.com.
Ta-da!
There you go.
And Shasta Lake City is a budding metropolis, by the way. It's not a city.
Yes, it is.
There you go.
Yeah.
Just wanted to be clear about that. So, our guest today...
I like how you said budding.
But I know. I'm glad somebody got the joke. I was having a good time all by myself over here. So we have Officer Joe and Kathy with us because, of course, we're talking about our favorite topic. Nope, not national security. Nope, not the MoveOn.org email that I got last week that said that that the Democrats weren't getting any donations since Joe Biden got elected because nobody had any money, which I frankly thought was hilarious. Not that. It was something else. And we have Dr. Bertha Madras. She's our hostage on the telephone. She is a professor of psychobiology in the Department of Psychiatry at Harvard Medical School, amongst other things. And I do hope you will go online and look at all the great information we have on there. And Officer Joe has his hand up here in the you have the talking stick. You want the talking stick?
Dr. Madras, if you could get the – I'm sitting in the corner like in a dunce chair, and I have my hand high in the air because I get the chance to talk to you, and I just want you to know I absolutely respect you and love all the training that you do for citizens in the United States. So back to marijuana. One of the things that you talked about
– foolishness is over now. Ding!
One of the things you talked about was a classical sign of addiction, which is the body's response to marijuana – and its ability to need more and more to get the same high. And that's a classic, that's one of the classic signs of addiction. Could you address how does marijuana actually work on the brain and talk about metabolites and maybe tell us what those are, where they stay in the
sure.
body, how long they stay in the body, those kind of things.
Well, what is fascinating about marijuana is that no matter how much we think we know how it works, we keep still finding new things about what it does to the brain. And the simplest explanation is that the marijuana signals are abnormal. They're not the normal signals that the brain produces with its own cannabinoid system. So there are cannabinoids produced by the brain. They target a site called the CB1 receptor. That receptor translates the signals and sets off a whole shopping list of events in your brain. Now, marijuana looks like some of your own chemical signals, but it's not identical. Because it's not identical, it triggers different signals. It triggers signals that are longer, that are stronger, and sets off a whole cascade of events in your brain that is abnormal. So what happens? One of the first things that happen to the brain is that the so-called CB1, the cannabinoid receptor, the target of marijuana, goes way down. It decreases tremendously. What are the consequences of it decreasing? It means that the brain can no longer respond to THC in the same way because its target is disappearing. Let's say you have a key that you put in a lock, and each time you keep using the key, the lock shrinks and shrinks until there is no longer a place for that key to go. So marijuana causes that target to slowly gets lower and lower, and as a result of it, you need more and more marijuana to produce the same effect. You've got to flood the brain with more and more to produce the feelings and sensations that you want to get from using the drug. So tolerance is one of the examples in which marijuana has an addictive potential. Another one is withdrawal. Yes, especially with high-potency marijuana, you can suffer a very severe withdrawal depending on how much you've used and how frequently you've used. Now, a long time ago with very low-potency drug, there wasn't as much withdrawal. There was withdrawal, but not to the same extent. But because the brain is hyper-adapted now to these very potent forms of marijuana, the withdrawal becomes more and more prominent. And it happens in about 30 to 40% of people who are addicted to the drug. That percent may get up higher depending on whether or not more and more people are going to use higher and higher doses. And that withdrawal includes insomnia, restlessness, irritability, stress reaction, loss of appetite. It can also involve stomach cramps. It can involve a few of the withdrawal symptoms, but milder than opioid withdrawal. So there is a real physical as well as psychological spectrum of withdrawal symptoms after heavy use of marijuana. And another symptom of addiction is craving the drug, because people who undergo withdrawal, if they have sleep problems, if they have anxiety, they crave marijuana to try to alleviate the symptoms of withdrawal. And some people think that's one of the big drivers of using. It's not merely to recapture that old that old high, but also to relieve the symptoms of withdrawal that have been produced.
That makes sense. Just before we go to the next part, if you could move your microphone just a tiny bit, because we're getting a little bit of over whatever.
Is this better?
That's terrific.
When you say you need more and more to get the effect that they're looking for, in higher doses, I'm sure your body is, there's other areas of your brain that are probably going to suffer because of the higher levels of THC. Is there any research done on that? It's like with an alcoholic, you know, they got to drink more and more alcohol to get the buzz, but a side effect is it eats their liver up. Is there anything that...
Well, as I said, we are just beginning to compare low and high doses.
Mm-hmm.
In terms of basic science, it's very hard to do these experiments in living people because you can't extract a piece of brain and look at it. You
can only look at brain.
it's what I would say, highly unethical.
except, you know, when you drive around, I'm pretty sure there are those experiments going on somewhere.
Yeah.
I saw some of them last night on the highway.
But psychologically, though, with higher doses, as they consume higher and higher doses of the drug, they're getting the buzz they're looking for. But is the brain reacting negatively as well?
Yes. So there is very strong evidence that the higher doses confer greater psychosis.
Okay.
So that's obvious. I mean, that's a clear one, and that's getting, you know, Robin Murray, whom he mentioned, and his wife, Marta DeForti, they published a beautiful study in 11 different sites showing that, and they focus particularly on Paris, London, and Amsterdam, and they showed that if a person uses daily or more frequently than daily and uses very high doses, their risk for developing psychosis just soars. It's sky high. So, in fact, in Amsterdam, they think about half of the cases of schizophrenia could be attributable at some point in time. Hmm. To very high potency marijuana.
So are they having higher instances of schizophrenia per capita than countries that don't?
In one or two European countries, they already have the data for that. We don't have it in the U.S. because we're far behind on studying marijuana and psychosis in the U.S.
Hmm. Yeah, because we don't want anybody to know.
Yeah, that's exactly it.
If you don't study it, nobody will know. It's not hurting anyone.
Dr. Madras.
Well, you know, there should be routine testing for THC after every accident, after every fatality,
right,
after every episode of psychosis. We're just not doing it in all the states, and that's a tragedy. We're not gathering the data that we desperately need. The Europeans are ahead of us this way. So that's a very important point. So psychosis clearly involves a rewiring of the brain, a rewiring of certain networks. But there's a new piece of data that has come out just in the past 2 years, partly from Yasmin Hurd's lab at Mount Sinai and our own, showing that high doses of THC confer an inflammatory response in certain parts of the brain, but only in adolescents and not adults.
Oh, wow.
What is so fascinating about this...
Wait, say that one more time for people who missed it.
That at high doses, THC produces an inflammatory response in a very critical brain area. A brain area that is critical for thinking, for emotional responses to the world, and it's networked into a whole host of things that I won't get into. But this brain area is a critical one during adolescent brain development. And the inflammatory response is very highly correlated with high doses, and it's found primarily in the adolescent brain, not the adult brain.
Does that mean, Dr. Madras, that the developmental and neurological disorders and learning deficits in pediatric or young adults, that's the reason for it? Is this inflammatory response?
It could be the reason. What we are trying to do and what Yasmin Hurd's lab showed is that if after exposure during adolescence, in this case it was animals, but they did the same test in human adults. After exposure during adolescence, but then no exposure thereafter. In other words, as adults they don't use, but they only use during adolescence. They're finding in neuropsychological testing differences between adults that have been exposed during adolescence and not exposed. And some of those are that they are greater risk-seeking, they have greater impulsive behavior, but there are others as well. And we are beginning to think, and we just have a theory, but we don't have the data. So just bear with me for a moment. This brain region, besides being involved in stress response, in anger, in violence, in sleep disorders, and a whole host of things, is a critical brain area for facial recognition. And if a person is able to recognize not only faces, but identify expressions in faces, they can read another person. They can develop empathy for them. If another person is sad, they can see it. They can recognize it. Teens who use marijuana lose this capacity of being able to recognize emotions and being able to recognize faces and facial expressions. And one of the possibilities is that this inflammatory response, this is just a theory, it has no science yet behind it, but one of the theories is that the loss of this ability by this inflammation in this brain region could give rise to adolescents being unable to recognize and develop empathy towards other people with regard to fear, to sadness, and all that.
Wow.
And we don't know yet. We don't have the thread. But could this be a contributing factor to increased violence?
And anyone who's ever had a teenager in their house knows that they're already just so easy to work with. I can't even imagine the added difficulty in communication just with parents and their kids. We have to take a really quick break on that note, but I think we should, in the archive, maybe we'll take that like 5 minutes and just play it over and over and over and then go to the rest of it. That was really important. We'll be right back.
Yeah. feel good. I knew that I wouldn't. So good, so good. I got a year. Oh, I feel nice. The sugar is fine.
I used to have that for a ringtone on my phone when he screamed, I feel good. It was so much fun, especially if you were like in the doctor's office or church or something.
Yeah.
All right.
Dr. Mesh, I had a question, follow-up question on the psychosis. People that partake in high THC develop these psychotic issues, and what you were just talking about, not being able to recognize facial expressions. Is this something that is reversible in adolescence or adulthood? I mean, does it work differently for young people than older people, where their brains are already pretty much developed?
You know, it's an excellent question, of which we certainly don't have the final answers on that. And science never has final answers on anything. Let me just give you a quick rundown of marijuana and psychosis. The first published report of marijuana and psychosis came out of India in 1895.
Wow.
So that's, you know, 200 years ago. And what it showed is a little bit less than 200, but a long time ago. What it showed is that people in the so-called insane asylums, which they called it then, there was a very high relationship between marijuana use and madness or schizophrenia or psychosis, whatever one labels it. And the association was much less with alcohol or with opioid use or with other drug use. So people concluded that there is something there about marijuana and psychosis. Then the Swedes, they have wonderful records on all their conscripts into the military. And they showed just about three decades ago, a little over three decades ago, that people who had used marijuana before being conscripted into the Swedish Army, they had a higher prevalence of psychosis and schizophrenia than the recruits who had not used marijuana before being recruited in the Army. And so gradually this linkage began. And then a professor at Yale, D'Souza, he showed that if you give marijuana to otherwise completely normal people who have no evidence of psychosis, but you give them a reasonably high dose, they're going to develop symptoms that are characteristic of psychosis. So it began, the information began to gradually build up until now there is very strong a relationship between the use of marijuana and the prevalence of psychosis and the dose response relationship. In other words, the higher the dose, the greater the risk. And it seems that marijuana is even riskier for young people in terms of developing psychosis. And people who already have schizophrenia, which is a sort of a chronic version of psychosis, they are... Their symptoms are exaggerated with the use of marijuana. They get worse, and they have more rehospitalizations. So there is really, and the other interesting piece of information is that if people come in to the emergency department with a psychosis due to marijuana use that's precipitated by marijuana, their likelihood of converting to a chronic disease, if they continue to use, is somewhere between 25% and 40%, depending on the study. So basically, marijuana is a risk for psychosis, but if you remove the marijuana, the symptoms lessen. And the use of marijuana combined with psychosis is just going to make things worse. Now, if you develop psychosis and don't use marijuana thereafter, the likelihood is that you may not have another episode. But if you continue to use, you increase the risks.
Hmm. Okay.
Dr. Madras, would it be safe to say that I've read studies out there that implicate cannabinoids and CBD in a diverse spectrum of congenital anomalies? In other words, we're not there to say permanent harm yet, although I think we should. But do you agree that people like Dr. Stuart Reese are showing that there's permanent changes now
I'm very familiar with Stuart Reese's information. I don't think that the jury is out yet on making that a definitive conclusion. What we can say with the American study, the ABCD study, which is ongoing now, it's called the Adolescent Brain Development Study, Adolescent Brain and Cognitive Development. It's been funded for 10 years, and what they do is they start young people at the age of 9, and they're going to monitor them until they are post-adolescence. And what they have found, first and foremost, is that kids who were exposed to marijuana in the uterus by marijuana-using mothers, they have, at the age of 9, pre-psychotic symptoms. They have symptoms that suggest that they already have some form of abnormal thought processes. Now, whether or not that goes away, we do not know. But there is, with this study, a growing interest in what happens to young people if they use during adolescence or if they're exposed in utero. And so far, the data are not very very promising. It is not a wise thing to use either during adolescence or if you're pregnant. It really is quite disconcerting. The reversibility, we still don't know. We may have those answers in 5 or 10 years or so. The other thing in terms of congenital problems, you know, getting back to Stuart Reese's research, is that women who use marijuana, they are going to have a higher prevalence of premature births. They're going to have infants that are born of smaller birth size, infants with smaller head circumference, infants whose reactions, you know, they're tested within the first few minutes. Their reactions are a little bit less than normal. So there are already signs that there are problems associated with being exposed in utero that I think are fairly well accepted. The congenital ones are correlations at this point, and I think we still have a way to go to say that correlation is really causation.
Where does THC deposit itself in the body? It's a fat soluble drug, and can it be the problem we have with? By the way, let me give you some statistics for Northern California here. About 25% of our females, 15 to 24 childbearing age, are now using cannabis as a drug for morning sickness. About 95% of our high school age students have been exposed in some form to marijuana in the last month. It doesn't mean they used it, doctor, but they discussed it, they saw it used, or they used it themselves. It's the easiest drug to obtain in our Northern California counties, far easier than alcohol. And in our DUIs, we found that in surveys, that almost 50% of the people were saying that, yes, they were reporting marijuana and alcohol use, which, as we both know, makes you higher and drunker. And we don't test for it in the state of California because the test costs $75. And if we arrest you for DUI alcohol, we've already convicted you under the law. So they don't bother to go after the THC component unless it's a fatal and they can determine that THC or that marijuana was used in that. What's your opinion as to where it's deposited in the body, and can it, can you have reemergence of symptoms? Because a lot of people say, well, I got high 3 days ago, but now I'm not going to test positive. And if you test me and I still have THC in my system, you could falsely convict me of drunk driving 3 days later. What's your opinion about where it deposits itself, and does it have a cumulative effect in the body?
Yeah, those are excellent questions. So, first of all, marijuana stays in the body for weeks because it deposits itself in strange places, in the brain with certainty, because it's very lipophilic, which means it loves fat. And the brain is a very fatty organ, because the brain uses fat to insulate its wires that connect one nerve cell to another. It also is found in reasonably high concentrations in muscle, which is kind of strange because muscle is not fat, and yet there is a significant amount in muscle. It's found in liver. It's found in other organs. Now, when our society was using marijuana at about 3%, the 3% can clear. It will still take weeks to clear, but the amounts that will leach out of the brain and other parts of the body is low, and that's why people did claim that there's no such thing as marijuana withdrawal, because the marijuana just leaks out so slowly that you don't go into withdrawal. With extremely high doses, the brain is so neuroadapted that when those it starts to clear out of the body, you still can have very robust symptoms. As to whether or not there is psychological impairment 1 day or 3 days or 10 days later, I can just say that there are some studies that say that you can be impaired significantly 1 day later. A person should not fly a plane if they took marijuana 24 hours before, and so on. And Canada is trying to establish those regulations for people in the safety-sensitive jobs. But in research, generally speaking, the researchers will, if they want to do psychological testing, they will not test a person unless they have been cleared for at least 3 weeks, because they still feel there could be residual effects of their last dose up until 3 weeks. And in our lab, we have found, for example, that blood levels are not at all indicative of what's in the brain. The brain levels are about 2 to 3 times higher than what's in blood. So if a person tests less than 5 nanograms per ml in blood, their brains are still 12 to 15 nanograms. They're much higher than blood.
And I think it's interesting that we are worried about safety-sensitive jobs. I don't care if you work at McDonald's and you operate the fryer. You drove there.
Yeah.
So, I mean, honestly, this affects everybody. These people are on the roadways.
Would I want my child to be taught or have a babysitter who's intoxicated? No. Would I want my pilot? No. Would I want my train engineer? No. Would I want the person on the highway coming towards me? No. I'm finding it hard to conjure up a job in which I would feel comfortable if the other person had marijuana on board.
Yeah, it's not going to improve. It doesn't improve anything, and there's a lot to process these days. You know, there's a lot. The world is complicated, and anything that dulls that just doesn't seem like a super smart idea.
Well, so much of our jobs are data entry, and look at some of that stuff is critical. And
yeah, you wonder how your name keeps getting misspelled on those name tags for.
There you go.
It's happening. Yeah. We have to take a really quick break. We'll be back with our guest, Dr. Bertha Madras. And that is all. Down, you never grow old. I'm tired of screwing up. I'm tired of going down. I'm tired of myself. I'm tired of this town. Oh, my. Oh, hell yes. Honey, put on that party dress. Buy me a drink. Sing me a song. Take me as I come, cause I can't stay long. Let's dance with Mary Jane. One more time to kill the pain. So before we cut back into that, Kathy has a local announcement that I know we'll run out of time at the end.
Oh, thank you.
Cue the local announcement.
Yeah, April 22nd is National Drug Take Back Event. We will be in front of City Hall, Reading City Hall, 10 to 2, with Reading Police Department and some other agencies handing out information. Please come and dispose of your expired and unused medications free of charge.
Ta-da.
Can we bring our marijuana down there?
So don't flush it down the toilet?
Yeah, please don't.
Yeah.
Let's not put it in the landfill.
Yeah, let's not do that.
Let's not leave access for our teens to get their hands on it. Let's just
let's face it. The dope growers have got so much chemical in the ground and everything. Yeah. You add to it, and we're going to start seeing people that aren't really human anymore.
And we do take vape pens and vape devices also, as long as you remove the battery.
So, Dr. Madras, we want you to understand that we live in an area of Northern California that is the epicenter and basically the beginning of illegal marijuana growing in mass amounts in the United States. And we've seen what it's done to our communities. It's literally destroyed our communities. But I wanted to come back to the risk of injury. And we've talked about youth, and when we know that it affects the pruning in the brain, let's talk about risk of injury to older adults, because we now have a population 50 to 80 plus that are now using cannabis. Could you discuss that and what the risks are for our society for that?
Yes. Well, the thing, could you hold one?
Sure. Yeah,
Are we talking stall for time?
Yeah.
So the thing that we have to remember is that cannabis does a few things to anyone. Under the influence, it can disturb thought, cognitive function, motor coordination, induce sleepiness, and all of these things are potentially as devastating or more so for the elderly, because as you age, your cognition, your ability to think, to compute, to calculate, to remember is compromised. And marijuana exaggerates that compromise. Your motor coordination, your balance is also reduced, and marijuana reduces your motor coordination.
Perfect.
A study was done recently in which people who were using marijuana as medicine in their past their 55 or so were compared with people at that age range who weren't using marijuana. And what they showed is severe compromised cognition, more severe than if they were not on the drug. So I think one has to caution elderly people that whatever troubles you may have in terms of the process of aging, this may make things worse. Now, of course, elderly people, some say that it relieves aches and pains. It enables them to sleep. There are a whole host of self-reports that claim that marijuana makes them feel better. And we have to recognize that some people use and get away with it. And some people use and claim they feel better. But again, until there are randomized controlled trials that really look at very large populations, these claims live in the domain of self-reports, anecdotes, and I would never dismiss a person who says they feel better. I would only wait until the science clarifies whether or not that is true on a population basis.
Yeah. Or is it just, I feel better because I can't tell?
Well, you feel better because you're numb.
Yeah.
You know, exactly. You don't care.
I feel like I feel better.
A man in California who is, who I've had some very interesting conversations with. I'm going to try very hard not to identify him. But he is a physician who has seen thousands of people with substance use and substance use disorders. And one day I asked him what he thought was the most dangerous drug he had ever encountered. And I said, I'm not going to define dangerous. Just give me just a simple reaction. And he said, I don't even have to think about it. It's marijuana.
Wow.
And I was shocked. I was expecting heroin. I was expecting cocaine or methamphetamine.
Yeah.
Or hallucinogens, which could cause people to behave in acts that are very contrary to their normal personalities. And I said, marijuana, I did not expect that. Tell me why. And he said, because it is the drug of self-delusion. It is the most delusional drug I have ever seen with thousands of people. People recognize they have an addiction to heroin. They recognize that they have a problem with cocaine or with methamphetamine or with alcohol. But he said, in the case of marijuana, these folks have no clue of what's happening to their brains, to their motivation, to their ability to think, to the fact that they can't live without the drug. And they will defend it and defend it despite all the objective data that shows that they are really compromised by the continued and heavy use. And I thought that was one of the most interesting comments I'd heard from a practicing physician.
And we hear it and see it every day here on the street, too, Dr. Madras. Could you tell us about your current research and what emerging research you think that you're going to be involved in the future? And what's the future for marijuana in our country, big picture?
Yeah. Well, there's three things that I can share with you. One is we are looking at this inflammation, and I'll give you the brain region. It's called the amygdala. It's a region that is critical, as I said, for emotional reactions, for depression, for PTSD. Its network into the frontal cortex is critical for facial recognition, emotional recognition of faces. So it's a very key region, and we're trying to understand whether or not the effects persist, whether or not they can be opposed by using medications to prevent them from happening, and whether or not other brain regions, so far we haven't found it in other brain regions, but we haven't looked. We have 29 regions that we have prepared, and there could be others as well that are affected. So in terms of basic science, that is my current interest, including possibly developing ways of imaging these changes in human brain to see whether or not we can detect it in adolescence and whether or not it disappears if the adolescent stops using. In terms of these so-called cultural research that I'm doing. I'm doing research on trying to understand how important the influence of parents are with respect to their child's drug use, and specifically marijuana use. And some of our data are really, really interesting on the influence of parents and what kind of messages they transmit to their children that could be protective or, in fact, could facilitate use. We already published the fact that parents who use marijuana, even lifetime use, not past year use, but lifetime use, parents who use marijuana, present or in the past, their children are much more likely to use marijuana and even opioids. So parents have a critical role in this, in protecting their youth, their adolescent children, and their adult children. And they, I think it's imperative for them to realize how critical they are in the process of children deciding whether or not to use or not to use. And the final thing that I'm engaged in right now is developing a course with the university on what parents can do to protect their children from drug use. It's going to be about 20 hours, and it's going to be multimedia, which means video clips and personal stories and a lot of other things. And hopefully it'll be completed within this year.
You know, the other thing, if you want to, and there's multiple targets in the target market, right, for education, but I honestly, so much of this policy is being driven by the people who may have been involved with the 2% THC in the 60s and 70s, and they see no harm in it. Because, well, the stoners at their high school grew up and got jobs. So, obviously, it doesn't hurt anybody, and it's better than alcohol, and blah, blah, blah. You hear this all the time. And these are the policymakers who are bringing, you know, the flood of dope stores to the towns and approving commercial growing in our counties.
With no checks and balances. This is what gets me. You know, we were promised here in the state of California, you know, we're going to have all these checks, you know, from seed to sell. And who's doing it? Nobody.
No.
And who's going into these pot shops and testing these products? You don't know what you're getting when you walk in there.
But they just don't see.
They don't see the harm.
They're not seeing the harm. And so a really important target market are the people that are legislating all this at the federal, state, county, and local level.
Well, I fully agree with that. I've been trying to educate legislators for years now.
God bless you.
In many capacities.
Yeah.
In fact, we just did a Zoom session with in conjunction with the Department of Education, and all we heard the feedback from people on the Zoom, there were over close to 800 people on it, was how do we prevent this? How do we protect our children? What is going on? Why can't we intervene? Why can't we stop this? There's no prevention. So the first thing I would say is, number one, prevention is a critical piece of drug policy. It is absolutely critical, and there is lip service, but very little being done on prevention at the state, the municipal, and at the federal level. And for that, I say shame, 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 because there is so little education of parents, of children, of teachers, of anyone engaged that wants to end this what I consider a looming disaster. That's number one. Number two is that legislators, we have to recognize that their agendas are driven in part by campaign finances and by influence of very wealthy concerned parties in this. And if we don't get to the root of who's paying for campaigns, who's accepting campaign financing, and who's promoting and advocating for this, and trying to develop lists of people, lists of industries that are doing this, and how they're pushing back, because their pushback strategies are really very clever. Yes. We're not going to get a handle on it. The legislators are going to listen to the people who knock on their offices and come in
with a check
and in part help their finance their campaigns.
Yeah. Well, and it's such a large...
There are many people who use, who claim that, first of all, nothing happens to them. Secondly, it's therapeutic. And thirdly, this is an alarmist campaign without a basis in fact. And there is no question some people can use, they can get away with it. Many people can use and not get away with any consequences. We have to be able to counter those personal tales and anecdotes with good science. And the science is not getting out the way it should.
No, it's there's no accident with that. The suppression is really calculated, and you know, I don't know that we'll ever fully understand that. But I think when the public weighs in and tells their elected officials that they expect them to make decisions based on science and benefit children, your information on kids is amazing. Oh. Dr. Bertha Madras has been with us the last couple hours. And if you do not send this show to a friend, you are committing malpractice. There you go. Radio malpractice. Thank you so much, Dr. Madras, for being with us.
Thank you, thank you.
You have been listening to We the People, and you can find this show at wethepeopleradio.us. I'm having a ball.